is Joyce an alcoholic? Y'all are in for a treat. We came here from Panama City Beach, Florida tonight. We actually left home around 6. We've been on a tour to get here tonight. If you ever need to know how to get to Johns Creek from here, we can help you. And we can tell you how to get to Buford from Johns Creek. So we're on it. You are truly in for a treat. I love Tracy. She's a dear friend. And she's, before I knew her, she used to really feed my ego a lot. Before I knew her, she would just run up to me and hug me and kiss me and tell me how wonderful and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, who are you? I didn't know who she was. You don't know, and you don't know, none of us know, the people that we touch that we don't know that we touch. She'd been reading something I was writing. She got to know me from reading something that I wrote. I got to know her after that. You just don't ever know. When people say you may be the only copy of the big book somebody sees, it's true. It's very true. And what you're going to hear tonight is a serious how this program works. When the first time I heard Tracy share her story, I was absolutely mesmerized. She does as I do, and she turns it over, gives it to God. And what you'll hear is a message from God. And when you hear this woman speak, you'll know what she is an open channel for the God of our understanding to speak through. If you're new, listen up. If you're an old timer, listen up. I give you Tracy. Thank you.
Wow. This is a good looking group of alcoholics here. And that's not breaking the 12th tradition, saying that you're an alcoholic and that I saw you here. That's not what I'm saying. It's just a good looking group. I want to start by genuinely saying thank you for having a primary purpose. Because if you didn't have a primary purpose to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety, I would not be standing here today. Because I am an alcoholic, and my name is Tracy. And Jerry, thanks for asking me. When I was going back and forth with Jerry, it became very apparent to me that he loves what he does in AA and that he loves this group. And that in turn made me excited to come and drive all over everywhere to get here. So I love my home group, probably in a similar way. My home group is the Peace of Mind group in Flowery Branch. And I love all of the little cliches for home groups. You know, your name is great. I love that. And then the Peace of Mind. You get the play on word, the Peace of Mind. Peace of Mind. We have a great meeting up there. If you ever are up in the Buford area, come check us out. We meet on Mondays and Thursdays at 6:30, and then we meet on Saturdays at 9:30 a.m. I was at the meeting last night, and my meetings have been sporadic lately. And I walked in, and it's a big book study, and I get in there, and they're much further along in the big book than I remembered, because I'm sporadic. And they're starting the chapter Into Action. And it spoke to me. And I was sitting in the meeting, and I just absorbed all of it. And I went home, and I'm telling my husband, my God, I remember why I love AA. It's so great. You walk into a meeting, it just speaks to you, and it's wonderful, and this is great. And he looked at me and said, you say that every time you come home from a meeting. And so I started thinking about that. How is it that every time I go to a big book study, every time, I come home and I'm like, oh my God, that was divine intervention. Somebody was speaking to me. How is that possible that it happens every single time? And then it hit me that the 164 pages that are studied in big book studies are all about me every single page. And how cool is that? And then it hit me that if that's the case, which it is, then I am really truly an alcoholic. And I loved that. I would not have said that to you a year and a half ago. If you don't mind, I'd just like to start with a little prayer because I'm extremely nervous and just want to get out of myself for a second. So I'm just going to say the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as you will. Please remove me from myself tonight so that what I have to offer will be what you want. Take away my difficulties as I stand up here so incredibly nervous, so that victory over that and everything will bear witness to those that I would help of your love and your power and your way of life. May I do your will always, especially tonight. Amen. Okay, so this is the second time ever telling my story. The first time I told my story before that, it was at the friendship group, and Heather was last minute scrambling around. It's a Sunday night speaker meeting, and I didn't miss a single meeting my first year of sobriety. And so I've been coming around, and when her speaker didn't show, she was a little frantic. And she looks at me and says, hey, you've been coming here a lot, haven't you? She doesn't even know my name. And well, we haven't heard your story. Will you get up and tell your story? I said, no. And she turns to the guy who's on the other side of me and says, Joey, will you tell your story? And Joey said, sure, no problem. He gets up and he tells his story, and Heather looks at me and she's like, that's how it's done. So I am telling my sponsor that I have said no to someone in AA. And she's like, oh, you need to go have a talk with her and just let her know that, you know, you'll be happy to tell your story. I'm like, but I won't be happy to tell my story. You need to tell her. And so the next time I saw her, I had to say, Heather, I am just so excited to tell my story. Whenever you are ready, I am ready, and it's going to be great. So just let me know. And she said, great, 3 weeks from today, done. And so there I am, stuck having to tell my story. And to my sponsor, you know, what do? How do I tell my story? Well, you go up there and you tell everybody what it was like for you, what happened, what it's like now. And I'm thinking to myself, that first year sitting in those speaker meetings week after week, that's what I heard. I heard the same story from everybody. And I don't want my story to be like that. Everybody had the same story to me, new, especially those first couple months. It was, you know, life was okay. It was all right. And then I found alcohol, and it got better. And then it was great. But then things went bad, and they went really bad. But then I found AA, and now everything's better. And I heard that story over and over again, and I was cynical when I came in. And I would sit back there and go, oh my God, everybody's got the same damn story. I'm not gonna get up there, and I'm not gonna tell that story. I'm gonna be different. I'm gonna be better, and that's not gonna be the deal. And I sit down to review my history and kind of what it was like for me. And I end up getting in front of the group, and this is the story that I tell. It was okay, life was all right. And then I found alcohol and things got good. And then they were really good. It was great, actually. And then it went bad, really bad, extremely bad. But then I found AA. And now things are better. Things are good. Things are really good. So thank you. Good night. I'll add some details here and there. So I was born at the age of zero. And I truly feel like I was born an alcoholic, that even at a very young age, things bothered me that I don't think bothered normal people. And I think this is a great example. I didn't wear pants until after fifth grade. I was in a dress all the time. And we lived in the north. And so freezing cold, playing out in the snow, I'm in the woods, it didn't matter. I was absolutely not wearing pants. And that doesn't make any sense. If you're cold, you put on pants. But when I would put on pants, when you're wearing the pants and you go to sit down, the zipper kind of does this like little thing here, and it gave me this penis. I didn't want a penis, and every time I would sit down, I would feel this penis there, and that was. So I take it upon myself, and I'm just not gonna wear the pants, and that's how I rolled as a kid. If it wasn't right, pants, right? I look back on it. And that's when, you know, I'm seeing this sort of alcoholic, like, no, I'm not doing that. I'm gonna do it my own way. Even if it's dumb and stupid and it doesn't make any sense. Even if it causes me pain and I'm freezing and my feet are blue, I'm not gonna do it. So we moved around a lot. My parents were great, good parents. My dad was a hard worker. My mom was diligent mom, loved us. But because my dad was such a hard worker, climbing the corporate ladder, we moved around. We started in Pennsylvania, and then we're down to Georgia, and we're back to Pennsylvania, and then we're to Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, back to Pennsylvania, and it was tough on me. Now, if you asked me, I would tell you, it's no problem. It built character, and that's why I'm such a people person. But the truth of the matter was that I hated it, and it sucked. And I remember truly, truly hating alcohol for the first time when I was in third grade. And I had one friend, because I didn't have any friends. I didn't have those grassroots neighbor friends, you know. And this friend was able to come spend the night with me. I was like, so great. Yay, friend. And so she's over, we're running around, we're playing, and there was a lot of alcohol in my home. My parents were huge drinkers, and their weekends were full of parties and fun and alcohol. And so my friend's over, and my parents are next door at my neighbor's on the patio drinking, me and my friend out running around, third grade. And apparently this girl's mom is calling the house and nobody's answering the phone. So the mom drives over to the house, and she screams up the driveway, jumps out of the car, grabs her child, runs over to my parents, pointing her finger at my parents, saying something about alcohol, how dare you drink while you're in charge of my child, scoop up my friend, and she's gone, and she can no longer associate with me. And I was devastated. I vividly remember just hating alcohol, and why, and it made no sense to me, and I was so angry. And I didn't hate alcohol like that again until 25 years later. I actually fell head over heels in love with alcohol in between those two times. And when I got sober and I was on the floor of my bedroom just crying, unable to let go of this love of alcohol and just devastated by what it had done to me, my sponsors, you know, Tracy, you gotta give it up, man. You just let it go. Why don't you write like a Dear John letter or something? And all right, so at that point, I'm willing to do just about anything. And so I wrote this letter, and I want to read it to you. It was written in desperation. It starts out like this. Dear Al. Get it, Al? I've seen this day coming for quite some time. I never wanted to admit it because I thought you made me feel so good. But we're just not meant to be. Our relationship started so young. Looking back now, I resent that you took advantage of my impressionable state. You told me that everything was going to be okay, and for a while it was, and you introduced me to all your friends, and you made me feel special and funny and smart and even safe. And so I bought into you. And damn, I spent a fortune too. While I was investing everything I had, you were scheming, plotting, if you will, my demise. You set me up to fall hard. All the pieces were in place. You set the stage. You cast all the characters. You made sure that everything I was involved in centered around you. You only allowed other people in my life if they too thought you were great. You filled me with false confidence. I tried to leave you many times, only to find that your influence over me was too powerful. You took from me my own ability to decide. I was so blind. I look around at all the relationships that I built with you by my side, and now I have to question what they even mean to me. You not only became the king of my universe, but somehow you managed to invade everyone else simultaneously. And now that I've decided to leave you for good, your presence elsewhere is so evident. I'm just obsessed over you. I've landed in a place of craziness, and it was you that delivered me here. You became so demanding, insisting that I take you everywhere, even to work. You wouldn't leave me alone for a minute. I couldn't sleep properly or eat correctly. My body became unhealthy. The things that I used to enjoy fell to the wayside. Exercise, reading, hiking, gardening, even just lying in the sun. It started off slowly. You allowed me to do those things, but only if I was spending time with you in the process. It came at a price, whether it be a hangover, foggy memory from the night before, or even just that plain old shitty feeling that only you can create. You became the other man in my life. You were sneaky about it too. You would insist that you be present at all my husband and I's most intimate moments, easing our minds and settling our fears. You would invoke laughter and silliness, and then you would leave us to mindlessly intertwine with each other. As the years progressed, you ensured that we were together, but you kept us apart at the same time. We built our life around you. My husband and I would be in the same room or at the bar, but we weren't together. Our union became empty unless it was filled by you. It was all about you. You made me believe that I could only handle situations if you were present. Instead of allowing me to try things on my own, you brainwashed me into feeling dependent on your guidance to tackle any and all challenges. The liquid courage that you provided has left me now wondering how to tackle even the most basic of issues. How did you do that? You're overbearing, thoughtless, selfish, and honestly a tyrant, stripping me of my very most basic rights and leaving me feeling helpless and scared. You've made it so that as I try to break free from you and I feel alone, I can't talk to anyone about it. As I cry in my bed and I want my mom, you made me feel uncomfortable even to talk to her about it. I hate you, I hate you, I hate you. I hope you die a miserable death. And as I hope this for you, I also know that losing me will mean nothing to you. You will move on to your next victim and you'll never look back. And I'll be left to pick up the pieces and put my life back together. I hope that one day I'll look back on the past 25 years and I'll be thankful for the times that we had because of an awakening that they hopefully will allow. But right now, I just want to make it through the morning. You did that to me. Did I mention how much I hate you? And that was me, man. I was in a bad spot. Okay, so we move around a lot, and I hate alcohol, and we're moving, but make a friend, and we have this great idea. We're gonna smoke cigarettes and see what happens. And so we get a pack of cigarettes and we find an empty apartment that was open and we go in there and it's me and my friend and I'm in seventh grade and we're in the middle of the empty floor and my shoe was an ashtray. And we thought if we take this cigarette and we light it and we inhale it as hard as we can and then we chug water, the water will push the cigarette smoke down and we're gonna get really, really buzzed. And so that's what we did. We would light the cigarette and we would smoke it. Just go and take the water, chug in the water, chug, chug, chug. Thinking that that was going to do it. It was a really quick look at what I was going to do the rest of my life. Smoke cigarettes and chug stuff. At that point, I was off to the races. My first stint with alcohol, my dog had died. I was in eighth grade, and I was devastated. And how else do you make yourself feel better in a home where all you see is people drinking alcohol for fun and enjoyment, and if something's wrong, I'll just have a drink and it'll be better. And so that's what I did. My friend and I drinking, chugging vodka for the first time ever. We don't know if you chug a bunch of vodka, it's not going to be good. So we head off to the basketball game, and I end up in the stall, everything's spinning around, and there's this knock on the stall. It's my principal, takes me to the office, need to call your dad, what's his number? Oh, you know, and I give her a number, not the number, but a number. And, you know, Mr. Gardner, your daughter's here, and she's very into... Oh, you don't have a daughter? Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize. And this goes on five times before she gets frustrated and then says, well, I'm going to go to the front office and look through the files. And we, you know, computers weren't happening then. So when she gets up to go look for the number, I'm gone. And I'm running down the hall of the high school, and I get caught, and, you know, parents and all that. But then it's drinking. And I'm in Austin, Texas, and if you've ever been there, there's a place called Sixth Street, and it's just bars and it's parties. And so here I am, you know, 14, 15 years old, and I'm lying to my parents and staying out all night and getting a job, making the donuts, because that was the 4 a.m. to noon shift. And I could easily lie about, I'm going to spend the night with my friend. They're going to give me a ride. My parents don't want to take me to make the donuts at 4 a.m. You know, they're starting their hangover at that time because they're drinking until 1 or 2 in the morning. It's fun, and I'm having a good time. And we move again. And that's great, too, because now I know how to party like nobody else in this little town. And I look really good and really like a lot of fun. And I am the talk of the town, and it's great, and I'm having a blast. And it's time to go to college. And I've got great grades. I mean, I'm managing the whole thing, and it's wonderful. But my parents are catching on. They're starting to ground me, that sort of stuff. So I want as far away from them as possible. I applied every college outside of a 600-mile radius from my parents. And end up accepting an offer to the University of Georgia. And there I go. When I talked earlier about, I feel like I was born an alcoholic, for me, looking back, the alcoholism manifests itself in me differently. You know, it starts with not wearing pants. You know what I mean? And then I get to college, and I thought I was special. I was the drinker, I was the partier, and it was great. And when you head off the University of Georgia, I was one of many people just like me. And so I was no longer special. And that sucked. And I didn't enjoy that feeling. I wanted to be the life of the party. And I think my alcoholism at that point switched on me. And I became a very active bulimic. And I was doing the same sort of alcoholic behavior. I was filling that hole. You know, this is the whole story. So I've got this hole and I need to fill it. And I can't continue to fill it with alcohol because I have to have the grades and I have to function. I can't be doing this every day. And so I find myself just using food. And I'm able to maintain an awesome GPA because during the week and going to classes, I'm using bulimia to make it through the day. And then on the weekends, it's just partying balls and drinking alcoholically. It's great. Sorry. And that's hard. And I hate that the alcoholism that I see in myself It's so destructive like that. All the things I'm doing out there to make myself feel better because I have a hard time coping with life. I don't deal well with it. The way I choose to help myself, it results in punishment of my own body. And that's just stupid. And that went on and on. But I'm making it work somehow. I'm getting the degree in psychology, getting a master's in social work. I've decided to kind of take this path, focusing on drugs and alcohol. I'm going to be a counselor there. My alcoholism runs in my family. I have a cousin who's been sober 25 years. She's a member of AA. And my papa was, he was the alcoholic everybody loved. You know, never met a stranger, carrying on, having a great time. And then my aunt, my mom's sister, she's the worst kind of alcoholic. She's a dead alcoholic. And it was watching her and her alcoholism, because she wasn't my papa alcoholic. She was the, you know, can't keep it together, can't keep a job, in and out of rehabs all the time. And I hate this for her because she's my love. You know, she's the one person in my family that's so near and dear to me. And I saw what a struggle life was for her. It was tough. She was alcoholic. She was gay. And it was really rough. But we were tight. I would sneak her beers in the bathroom. So she was letting me drink, and I was letting her drink. And it was great. But she was getting sick and kind of guided my path. So here I am studying alcoholism and practicing alcoholic behaviors and not seeing any of it. It's the denial in my story is unbelievable. And so I am living in active alcoholism, but managing the hell out of all of it. And meet my husband. Where else do you meet a husband when you're an alcoholic, but in a bar? And he's a partier, and we party, and it's great. And we're good together, and we're fun. And if you want to have a great party, you better invite Tracy and Michael. And that's how it goes for a while. I have a kid, and I'm drinking, and I'm working, and we're partying. And I'm not exactly sure when it becomes really unmanageable. But at this time, already putting little 4-packs of wine in the console of my car, so that, because my daughter was, she was, I think, also born alcoholic, and she doesn't deal well with life. And that's hard to parent, really hard to parent. And so there's my reason, my rationale, you know. So I'm drinking wine before I go pick her up from daycare, because I need that just to get her home, because she's going to be screaming, crying. But I don't see any of this as not okay. It's completely fine. And this sort of behavior just kind of continues. But I'm not alcoholic because I can stop. And I do. But I don't stop because I'm drinking too much. I stop because I need to lose some weight. I stop because my husband's drinking too much and I need to show him the way. I stop because I need to focus on my career for a little bit. But I'm able to stop, and so I'm definitely not like my aunt, who at this point is very sick and dying. And to watch that kind of an alcoholic death was hard on me, and I was not identifying myself in that realm at all. I remember every time I would stop vividly where I was and what drink I had when I started back up, every single time. Because it was like heaven coming down to earth and touching me, and I'm able to drink again and I'm off. And it gets worse every single time. It gets to the point where it becomes really difficult to have that stopping period for any reason. I'm like, New Year's Eve, that'll be it. And New Year's resolution, that's good. But then there's the Super Bowl. And so, I mean, you got to drink at the Super Bowl. So I'll wait till after that. But then there's my birthday and Valentine's Day. So it'll be after that. But then there's spring break. And you got to drink spring break. And then after that is summer, and there's the lake and the pool and the beach. And so not going to happen then. So at the start of the next school year, then there's Halloween. I mean, who doesn't drink and hand out candy to kids and drink and trick or treat? So it can't be then. So now I'm into Thanksgiving, but I'm so thankful for alcohol. So I need to. So then it'll be Christmas, New Year's. I'll definitely New Year's. Then there's the Super Bowl. And I run like that for a while. And there aren't any real consequences because I'm sneaky about it, and I'm not driving, making sure somebody else is if we're out, but most of the drinking is happening in my house. And then it happens, the consequence. But it was not my fault. I'm gonna put it out there right now. I think the story is absolutely gonna support that. My husband and I, huge fight. We split ways early that morning. He goes downtown Atlanta to a music festival. I'm stuck at home with the kids. Make a plan. All right, I'm going to see a girlfriend. We're just going to have a couple glasses of wine. But damn, that makes me the driver because he's not around to drive me. So I'll just have to be really careful about the alcohol. And I remember being miserable the whole night because I was having to count the drink. You know, okay, that's one, that's two. I probably should stop. One more. But I make it home safe and sound. I let the babysitter go. My husband's not home yet, and I'm glad because, you know, we're all about the alcohol, and I'm gonna just pour a little glass of wine and read my book. Kids are in the bed, and that's what I do. And my phone rings. Hello, it's my husband. Honey, I'm upside down. I wrecked the car. I'm on 985. Oh my God. And the phone goes dead. Holy shit. Oh my God. I know he's been drinking all day long. He's upside down on 985. Call the babysitter. She comes back over. I jump in the car, headed southbound on 985. I passed the wreck because he was coming northbound. It's bad. Car's upside down. Shit's everywhere. Turn around, exit ramp, headed back north, pull up behind the accident. Cop cars everywhere. Ambulance taking off as I'm pulling in behind. Jump out of the car. Run over to the officer. Holy shit! What happened? That's my husband! Oh my God! Is he okay? After you've been drinking, do not go up to an officer and use every H that is possible. So long story short, I'm in the back of the car, going to jail for a DUI, and my husband's in the hospital. I have no idea how he is. I know for sure that he was going to be getting a DUI as well. So even if he was alive, we were both going to be in jail, and my two children are at home with my 14-year-old babysitter, and I don't know her phone number. My husband's smart enough to, and he remembers none of what happened in a complete blackout. This had happened for him. And so he gets to the hospital and declines all treatment. You know, he's like, I'm fine, catches a cab and goes home. Doesn't get a DUI because the officer's busy with me, giving me his DUI. Resentment. That's when it just takes off for me. Now I have every reason to, you know, to drink, and it's his fault. But, you know, it doesn't stop me. That kind of an accident, it was bad, you know? Just keep right on going. They reduce it down to reckless, because that's a hell of a story. And but I have to do the DUI class, and I'm not going to pay attention at the DUI class. I'm in there. I've got my phone watching some football on it. This poor instructor, I mean, she told me time again, put your phone up, put your phone up, put my phone up. And I've got alcohol in my car so that at lunch I can go out and drink and go back in and watch some more football. But nothing is wrong with me. I am not alcoholic. My aunt passes away and I am nothing like her. So it gets bad. And the summer of 2012, I take off with my mom. We go to Costa Rica, big girls weekend, you know, poker, just having a ball. And I'm full-blown alcoholism at this point. We get to the airport because you can't really take the wine and stuff on the plane. So as soon as we land in Costa Rica, I'm in the duty-free store in the airport, and I'm loading my suitcase down with bottles and bottles and bottles of wine. and I'm drinking on that trip, and I'm thinking nobody knows. And in the airport, I'm saying, I'll be right back. I have to run to the restroom. And I'm not going to the restroom. I'm going to the bar. But I'm passing one bar on my way to the next bar so that I can hit that bar on my way back. Thinking that they don't know, that it's fine. We get back from that trip, and my mom sits me down, and she says to me, Tracy, you remind me of my sister. And that's when it hit me. My alcoholic aunt, who's dead. And I remind, and my mom's a big drinker, so for her to say that to me was huge. And then it's like, all right, I'm not an alcoholic, I'm not my aunt, I'm gonna get sober, you watch, I'll show you. And this whole concoction of a plan comes into place, and I somehow managed to get my kids and my husband and everybody out of the house for a week. They're all off. And I curl up on the sofa and I detox myself. I'm curled up in the fetal position for a week, coming off of alcohol, pills, everything you can possibly imagine. I could have died on that couch, but I didn't know that. I'm not an alcoholic, nothing's really all that wrong. I'm gonna get it together. And I do, and I stay sober for 3 weeks. And I toy around a little bit with online AA kind of stuff. And I remember thinking, how dumb, everybody's got their first name and then their last initial. That's so stupid, I don't get that. If I'm gonna post something, I'm gonna come up with some, you know, cool name like Sexy Sober Sister or something. So 3 weeks, and then it's school's starting back up. And so just one last weekend, and then, you know, my career, and I'm gonna focus on that, so it'll be okay. And that's it. That's it. The progressive disease has progressed to the point where I can't stop. So now, the one weekend drink, and that's going to be it, because I've gotten sober and I've showed everybody I'm not an alcoholic that's going to die. Alcohol is going in every possible concealed bottle. It's in every nook and cranny of my house. Every possible stop that I can think of where I can throw bottles and things away. It's happening, and I've got the wine in my car, I've got it going to work with me, I've got it now coming into the workplace. I'm a school teacher. I run a gifted department. I teach the smartest kids, and I'm taking the alcohol into the classroom, drinking it, while I'm teaching these 13 and 14-year-old kids. Who does that? It's bad. All right, so it's all going down. Something's gonna happen, it's gonna blow. I'm gonna lose my job, my family, my kids, and it's all gonna happen like that, because I was managing that just, I mean, so much. There was so much managing going on, and it looked decent from the outside. I truly think there were some people who were shocked. And it was so much on me. And so I get, of course, a bottle of wine, and I pull into a cemetery. Not because there was really no relevance at the time, it was just a safe place where I could park my car and get on the phone and try to find a rehab. And I find a place out in Nashville, Tennessee, because I can't go anywhere around here because somebody will know. And that's it. I'm off to rehab I go. But I'm only doing 2 weeks because I'm gonna get it together in 2 weeks. I don't need the whole month thing, or certainly any longer than that. It's all situated and ready, and I go home, and the humiliation of telling my husband and my kids, you know, I gotta take off. It was bad. And I pay for it myself because I can't let insurance know, because then the job will know and then that'll go badly for me. So I come up with $10,000 to pay for this rehab. And when I come back, my family is now holding me, because they're big money people, so that now they're gonna hold me accountable because I've just spent $10,000. So I'm gonna have to do this deal, which I think is stupid, by the way. I can get sober and be sober and it's fine. And I don't need this AA thing, which is really dumb. But I'm gonna have to do the 90 and 90 because that's what the rehab said, and that's $10,000 for that, so I've gotta see that through. And I got to get a sponsor. I got to do that. And then I've got to work 12 steps. Surely I can do all those things. So I go to my first meeting, and it was all guys. And I like guys, so it was okay. And then I go to my second meeting, and I'm miserable in all of this. And I the meeting I go to, all of these ladies right here are in that meeting, and they're laughing and carrying on and having a good time, and I'm miserable. Cannot even believe that there's anything to laugh about. And they are dumb and stupid, and they don't know anything. And they pick me up at that point, and they have not set me down. I got sober September 12th, 2012. I think I missed that. So for over a year, these ladies have carried me every single day. And that's a huge reason why I love AA. So my second meeting, meet these guys, and they should try this speaker meeting on Sundays. You know, we come and we sit in the front row. The hell sits in the front row? No! And so after that meeting, an old timer comes up, of course, because that's what old timers do. They find the newcomer and, hey, how are you? So how many days do you have? And, you know, do you have a sponsor? And no, I don't have a sponsor. I really don't plan on getting a sponsor. I'm just going to tell everyone at home that I have a sponsor, because there's certainly nobody in here who knows more than I do. I've got a degree in psychology, a degree in social work. I've been a drug and alcohol counselor. So this is ridiculous, really. Oh, well, you should have Sonia sponsor you. And I turn and I look, and this woman who's standing here next to me, she has these diamond-studded scissor earrings, huge scissor earrings hanging down, and she's wearing this leopard print outfit, and she's a hairdresser. I don't do the hairdresser leopard print thing, so, this is not going to go well. I hate this program. And sure, you know, I'll sponsor you. And Sonia invites me into her home. And she starts me on the first step. And it hits me that it's unmanageable and it's bad. And then, you know, finding a power greater than myself. And there was no God. And that had to be hard for her, because I was absolutely certain that there was no God. She's given me what if it's, you know, just some radiation that's floating around out there, and she's throwing all these ideas out, and I'm shooting her down left and right. I look back now, and God was there the entire time. It was you guys. It was the God in skin, and I'm so thankful for that. So steps 2 and 3, they kind of came and went for me. I kind of said, all right, I get it. But I was on a mission to get through the 12 steps, do the 90 and 90, and then be done. And I had this silly little sponsor who was a hairdresser. So then the 4th step come, 5th, and all of a sudden, I'm looking at all the things that I have been fighting looking at and using alcohol to push away for so long, and I'm sitting with him and I'm looking at him, and she's holding my hand through the whole thing, and these ladies are just carrying me. And then the next thing I know, I'm sitting down in front of people who I hated, and you, everything you did to me, and I'm very humbly saying, I am so sorry that I stole your peace of mind. And I'm meaning it. How does that happen? And this whole time I'm fighting this program, and I don't like it. I don't want to have anything to do with it. While I'm doing that, behind my back, my higher power is working miracles in my life. And then I'm praying and I'm meditating, and I'm like loving this concept. I'm not just reading the daily reflections. I'm like sitting quietly for extended periods of time and really being present in life for the first time, and it's really amazing. And then I'm sponsoring women, and it's great, and this is a beautiful thing. And I'm turning around and I'm looking back at the year, and I'm like, yay, I did it, all right, and I think I've got this. And that's it, and that's where it happened for me. I think I got this. because now I've got a life, and my kids are in basketball, and it's great because, you know, I've got a life now. I would have never signed them up for basketball. That's like evening practices and weekends and stuff, and I'm hungover normally, and I'm certainly not going to do anything in the evening because I'm drinking. And I want to participate in my life now. So they're doing these things, and I'm involved in that. And you know what's slipping to the wayside is my sobriety and my meetings and talking to my sponsor. And then all of a sudden, these resentments and things, they're no longer me saying, you know, gosh, I'm sorry I stole your peace of mind. I'm right back in the, you know what, you really are an asshole. And I'm miserable. And every time somebody talks to me, when these women are talking to me, you know what they're hearing? They're not hearing, I love AA and I'm grateful. They're hearing, oh my God, this is terrible. My husband's a jerk and blah, blah, blah. And it's just, I'm throwing up all over them. And it's been rough. It's been a rough start to the second year of sobriety for me. And so to walk into that meeting last night, into action, I was very quickly reminded that the action in this program is what saved me. The sitting down in front of people and saying, you know, this is my part in it. The sponsoring women, working with them, going to meetings. All the stuff you hear, right? Setting up the chairs and all that stuff. But it's so true. I go to just one meeting last night and all of a sudden, I love AA again. And I want to come down here and I want to tell you guys that I love it and it works. The second that I think that I've got this thing, I'm going to lose it all. I'm going to just close with this. I was just spending a lot of time in this book today, wanting to come down here and really share with you guys, and I ran across this. As it is, AA has filled my days with friends, laughter, growth, and the feeling of worth that is rooted in constructive activity. My faith in and contact with my higher power shines more brightly than I dreamed that it could. Those promises that I thought were impossible are a viable force in my life. I am free to laugh all my laughter, free to trust and be trusted, free to give and receive help. I'm free from shame and regret. I'm free to learn and grow and work. I've left that lonely, frightening, painful express train through hell, and I've accepted the gift of a safer, happier journey through life. I am so thankful that you guys have a primary purpose. And I appreciate you letting me share tonight. Thank you.